That is such a wonderful introduction. You know, you don't know these things as a teacher, and then you hear a place like this. If you knew Hannah, you'd know how deeply, deeply touched I am by those comments. In fact, I'm kind of speechless, but I'll try to recover. I want to start by thanking you all for the opportunity to come here. I sort of filled in for Roger Epp for one course about just around the time of the merger, and I had a wonderful time. Just a wonderful time. So it's great to come back, but it's particularly great to come back. If I could just make one or two comments before I begin, to see, I think the idea of a university course that invites and encourages community participation is just wonderful. It's just everything that I would like to be and do as a teacher. So, but I have to say, in addition, it's particularly a pleasure for me to see in the audience two people, one of whom you will know, Gerhard Lotz, I'll just say, if any of you are on the faculty of the university, you should never let Gerhard buy a beer or a coffee for himself again. He was instrumental in bringing about a salary settlement for the academic staff last year that was the best in the country, that is the envy of people all across the country, although he did this at a very great sacrifice of his own time. So I guess this is just, I'd like to start by saying thank you on behalf of everyone I know for that. And the other, and I won't embarrass him here, but someone is here, there's a young man here who is profoundly important in my own spiritual life, and it's just very touching for me. I don't know how I'm going to sort of do this. What I would like, having talked to David, what I would like to do is to go over with you why it is the case that in the standard terms of public justification today, issues of religion and broadly of spiritual aspiration are pushed to the margin, if not excluded entirely. So I will do that in a couple of minutes, and I'll do it by talking about these two figures, more about them. But since I know that, since I looked over the syllabus, in fact, I did the reading that you guys have to do for tonight. So, and I noticed there's a lot there about rights. So I thought it might be helpful, since my own work, my own published work, has mostly been on rights. I thought it might help you if I just gave you like a very short, brief introduction to what we mean when we talk about rights. Okay. So this is going to be like 5 minutes and 97% of it. The remaining 3% occupies 15 shelves in any university library. Okay, and so it's going to be a little simplified. The standard, when we talk about rights, the standard use is we talk about a person having a right to something. Now, it could be a right to a piece of property, for example, your right to that pen, but it all might also be a right to the provision of some service. For now, that doesn't matter. But I notice that is your pen. Could I borrow it for a bit? Now, what would happen if I borrowed it and used it and then put it in my pocket and went back to the lecture and just didn't return it? Would there be anything wrong with that?
He wouldn't get a very good mark on his assignment.
Well, and I probably wouldn't get a very good mark on whatever evaluation you might be assigned. But insofar as it's your pen, you have a right to it, and that right includes the right to exclude other people from the use of it. But insofar as he has a right to that pen, everybody else has a duty not to use it without his permission. So in the standard, whenever we talk about a right, we're talking also about duties that other persons or other agencies have. And sometimes the most important part of the right consists in the delineation of what those duties would be. For example, do we have a right to health care in Canada? Yes. Do citizens routinely have a right to health care in the United States? What's that? Yes. One says yes. Anybody say, anybody disagree with that?
There's barriers to it, so I would say no.
That's right. What matters is what we mean by, what do we mean when we talk about a right to health care? And what that means is what duty it is that other people have to bear. In Canada, the right to health care means the right to be provided with health care. In the United States, there is a right to health care. It is the right to free choice in the selection of your own medical provider. In Canada, the duty is the duty actually to provide that health care. In the United States, the duty is just the modest negative duty not to interfere with people in that choice. So when we talk about a right to, the key thing is, I suggest, we typically, especially in politics, we get caught up in the language of rights. So everything hangs on, like a right to abortion on demand, or a right to this, or a right to education. The critical thing is always to work out what the duties might be. In other words, who has those duties, and against whom might they be claimed? So the other thing I would comment about sort of natural rights, since I know that is in the reading for tonight. There's two traditions for thinking about natural rights. I don't think I'm going to rock the boat with where you're going with this, but the classic tradition from the sort of classic theorists, Hobbes and Locke and some others, but the classic theorists was to understand human rights as natural rights. They came, in other words, the right to life, or in Locke's case, the right to life, liberty, and property. Locke thought they were based in our nature as human beings, actually. He thought they were based in our nature insofar as we are created by God. But they're based in nature. That was the justification for them. But you don't have to think about human rights in those ways. Remember, if you remember that what a right is, it's a device that lets the person who has it be protected in some way by duties that are borne by other people, duties which that person can claim. If you think of it that way, so like a right implies duties by some other person, duties which the right bearer can claim or require. So the point about a right, therefore, like we establish rights in order to protect people in certain important areas of their life. And the different rights, by the way, that a society will establish will reflect what that society takes as important. Is it health care? Is it the right to free speech? Is it the right to bear arms? Those are very different schedules of importance. And my point now, if I could come back to human rights, whereas in the 17th century, human rights were understood as based in the nature of the person. You don't have to think about human rights that way any longer. The UN Declaration doesn't. When ordinarily today, when we talk about human rights, what we mean, first of all, like it is a right that is possessed by all human beings. And insofar as it is a right, it will establish duties for other persons or human beings, duties which ideally can be claimed. So how would we know what rights to call human rights? Well, that depends on what you think is important. That's all. What are the areas of life that we as human beings need, where we need protection? Well, those are the areas of life, and we will protect them. And the final thing about the right, we'll protect them by putting a kind of fence around the person. That ability to say, hey, that's my pen, give it back. That ability to say that. That ability to require that someone else do something that's vital for your life, that's critical to a right. And so we can establish as human rights anything, any area of life that we want to protect is fundamental for human beings generally. Okay, I hope 5 minutes. So I'm going to get rid of all that. And
those are so gorgeous.
I give a PhD course in stick figures for philosophers, and okay. So the question is, why is it the case that issues of religion and more broadly spirituality are marginalized? Now, I want to use a term of art here. I'm going to use the term liberalism, but it's not liberalism as you may have understood it from John Stuart Mill, if you've read that kind of stuff. The word liberalism, as it is used in North American universities today, and increasingly in Western universities, has come to mean something else. It's broadly what liberalism just means the commitment to the full and free development of each person. Now, classical liberalism was all about freedom and liberty. This is much broader than that. It has a very much more substantial egalitarian dimension. So this, like, liberalism just means a commitment to protecting the opportunities for people for the full and free development of their lives. And that usually means not just liberties from interference, but also the provision of the basic goods that a person needs to lead a free life. But this liberalism, I think it has to be said, comes out of a particular historic phenomenon. It is the dominance of America and of American universities in Western intellectual life today. And I mean by that, there are things built into this understanding of liberalism that are not part of the political culture of Canada or Great Britain or Western Europe. But increasingly these things are coming into play. Because this liberalism, as I'm calling it, is generated primarily out of the universities, and remarkably, most of the universities in the world today are based in the United States. So this sort of dialogue that has developed there. Now that's important because we political philosophers, I say this, I wish it weren't true, but political philosophers, like, we like to be universal. We like to think we're sort of scientists. So when I say something like that definition of a right, it's going to apply everywhere. It's going to apply universally. And the trouble with doing that is we sometimes forget about the particular conditions from which our ideas come. And in the case of American political thought, there are a couple that are important. I'll just mention two for now. One I'll just mention because of its importance for tomorrow. American political thought is quietly haunted by the historical reality of slavery. You can open any number of books in political theory or political philosophy published in the United States and not see a single entry under the word slavery. And the word slavery won't be in the index. And yet, for conscientious, reflective Americans, the fact that their country practiced slavery is a scandal which infects and inflects, there is inflected through their thinking about political experience. But as I say, the difficulty is it's there, but it's there as a kind of ghost. But we don't need to go there now. I just mention it because of the significance of this particular week in the United States and in the world at large. But let me mention a second. The liberalism I'm going to be talking about, that liberalism has a very peculiar sort of take on religion. And it's a take on religion which has not been shared in Canada, Great Britain, or Europe. But as I say, with the increasing dominance of these ideas generated from the United States, it's coming to be more prominent. And here's what it is. You'll remember that several of the American initial states or colonies were founded expressly to avoid what they understood as religious oppression. Some of them were founded to avoid one kind of religious oppression and established another. My understanding, I defer to historians here, but my understanding is that at least two of the initial American colonies held it that it was a capital offense to be a practicing Roman Catholic. In one of the initial colonies, it was a capital offense not to be a practicing Roman Catholic. Well, they're all trying to get away from what they had suffered as a kind of religious oppression. Now, again, you won't find that mentioned in talks of political philosophy. It's only sort of somewhat, I guess, late in my life, I've begun to reflect on the importance of these historical things and the way that they come to be inflected through thinking. But it's going to be very important for this reason. There is a remarkable paradox about liberal thinking in American universities. And the paradox is this. Compared to all the societies in which I've traveled and lived, the United States is, without question, the most God-practicing country I've ever seen. More people regularly attend religious services in the United States than in any other church that I have seen. And the word God figures prominently on coinage. We'll hear it tomorrow in the Obama swearing-in ceremony and the oath of office. And yet, as you know, religion in the United States is categorically separated from public life. It is mandatory that religious issues, the very topic of religion, be kept out of public life. Now, with that, there's a kind of spin. And the idea is that religion is a matter of choice, and therefore it should be left to the private choice of private individuals. And the theme I'm going to be developing through my remarks tonight is a difference between the different ways we can understand that. I think we all want, at least all of us in any kind of tradition of freedom, I think we all want matters of conscience to be matters for freedom. I think we all want to avoid having a kind of society in which matters of conscience or matters of the practice of conscience would be mandatory or legislated by any group of authorities. I think we all want that. The question is, we can establish religious variety and religious diversity and religious choice as a public value that we all take seriously, or we can erase it from the, as it were, the blackboard of our public life by sending it into the private choice of private individuals so that it no longer exists in the public domain. And that's what I'm suggesting to you is what is happening, I believe, increasingly in the Western world as a result of this kind of, this special kind of liberalism. To illustrate that, I want to talk to you about two theorists. David said a little bit about them in an introduction, but I'll just say something about each of them to start, and then I'm going to talk mostly about Rawls. I'm going to... John Rawls, who died, it only seems like last year, but I guess it was 6 years ago. John Rawls is the single most important liberal or English-speaking political philosopher of the last 50 years, in my view, of the last 100 years. He is enormously important. Here's how important he was. He published his main work, A Theory of Justice. He published it in 1970. In 1967, I was in graduate school, and I was in graduate school in Oxford. Now, 1967 is the time of the Vietnam War. Sexual liberation, the birth control pill had been available for about 3 years at that point, so there's all kinds of liberation stuff going, egalitarian stuff, fighting against the war, fighting against poverty. In the United States, the racial desegregation battles, and then which led immediately into community development anti-poverty programs, which were also happening in Canada and then in Europe, and then along with that, the student protests. So there were like these huge, I mean, everyone of my age saw the world as a problem of justice. So I went to graduate school, and I said, I want to write a thesis on justice. And they said, you can't. They said, you can't because it can't be done. That's about values, and we don't do values. It was very hard to believe. I mean, I said, I was at Oxford, I said, they let me do that at home. Well, this is different here. Well, I have to appeal to the memory of some older people here. Do you guys, some of the older people, do you remember what a Gestetner machine was? Okay. Now, what was the thing that you typed? It was a stencil, right? So this is before Xerox machines. The only way to copy something was you typed it onto a stencil, and then you tied it to this drum, and you ran ink through it, and it printed out copies that way. Well, I had a friend who said, there's this guy in the United States who's giving a graduate course on justice. And one of my friends, what Rawls did was he issued, like, the textbook for the course was the draft of his book, which had been typed onto a stencil and run off and given to the students. These things were incredibly valuable. When the stencil was gone, they were all gone. You couldn't reproduce it from just one copy. So this friend of mine said, I've got a copy, and a couple of us are meeting. So we had this sort of underground meeting in Oxford. It was like Samizdat, for sure. Reading our way through John Rawls's A Theory of Justice. Well, Rawls' graduate students were really good. The first time he did it, they pointed out some problems with it. He said, I better not publish the book this way. So he revised it. So there was a second one. Next year, we're back with a new version. It came out three different times. Now, by the time, 1970, by the time that Rawls' book, A Theory of Justice, appeared, on the one hand, no one had thought it was permissible or possible to do political philosophy for something like 10 or 15 or 20 years. And on the other hand, everybody under the age of 25 who cared about the world had participated in one of these little underground meetings, right? So as soon as the book came out, there was this, it was just like an avalanche of literature on it. You know, like the book comes out and 2 days later there are critical notices, like 30 pages long, because we've all been studying the thing. But the reason for it was an opportunity to address these issues. And so I will tell you more about Rawls' theory in a few minutes, but I want to say, just by the way, that he was a giant in the intellectual world, oddly because he was very shy. Like he never gave interviews, he never appeared on television, he was never on the Johnny Carson show. So he was very shy, so his public reputation was like he really wasn't very well known. So that's Rawls, and I hope you remember all the things I've said about him, because I'm going to paint him in a way as the bad guy later on. Right? I don't mean that, but it's a kind of. Now, Charles Taylor, here's Charles Taylor, Canadian, born in 1931, still with us. In the early 70s, Charles Taylor was elected by the staff at Oxford to the what was then the major chair of moral and political philosophy in the world, the Cicelli chair. And it was elected. You had to be elected by the staff. Taylor accepted it on condition that it was a life position. He accepted it on condition that he only hold it for 5 years. And he did that because, he said at the time, he's Canadian. He actually, at that point, held a joint appointment. He taught political science in English at McGill and philosophy in French at the University of Montreal. He had five daughters. He thought it was important that they grow up in Canada, and that's where he wanted to spend most of his life. And in part, that's because Taylor remains, deeply committed to the political life of our country. Among other things, remember Pierre Trudeau? Well, before Trudeau became a Liberal in 1965, Trudeau had run unsuccessfully for the New Democrats in the same constituency in Montreal-Westmount. His campaign manager on each occasion was Charles Taylor. When Trudeau was recruited by the Liberals to run in 1965, I think it was 65, his opponent in that election was his former campaign manager, Charles Taylor. Taylor has recently been the co-chair of a commission of inquiry in the province of Quebec on multiculturalism, and a little less recently published a major 687-page book called A Secular Age. So he is not just a Canadian, he is one of, along with Rawls, one of the really towering geniuses in our intellectual life. And some of you may know him, or at least if you're interested in Taylor, he did the Massey Lectures about 15 years ago. And they are available, I think they're available in podcasts on the CBC website, but they're certainly available in written form, and like eminently readable book called The Malaises of Modernity. The Malaises, I'm sorry, not saying that very well. But I'm going to suggest, not that Taylor is the good guy as against Rawls, but Taylor makes this point about marginalization. Taylor came back to Canada and was teaching. He published a book called The Sources of the Self, which is like a major book. And at a couple of places in that book, when he's talking about sources of the self, he's talking about the broad range of human aspiration, of the things that matter to us. And I'll tell you a little more about what he's up to later on. But I just want to say for now, when he talked about the things that we can be like called to in life, or pulled to, and he meant by this like a very broad range of things. But he used to, maybe a half a dozen times in the 500 pages of the book, maybe half a dozen times, he used the word spirituality. Taylor, at that point, went from being one of the half dozen most highly regarded political moral philosophers in the Western world to becoming, in short order, an outsider. Political theorists don't much read him now. I have heard him kind of routinely described as a religious crank, which, if you knew Taylor, Charles Taylor, or whatever else he is, he's a man of broad, capacious, cultured understanding and tolerance. So it really troubles me. And it's partly out of watching that phenomenon happen. And I actually, having a conversation with David, and I sort of expressed my unhappiness about the way these things work, that he challenged me to try to put my thoughts in order or try to say something more systematic about that. So why is that? Why does this happen? I'm going to try to give you a... I'm sorry. I don't know how to, like, pull the page. Oh, yeah. Okay. I don't know. This is... Really, I'm not a Luddite, but I guess it looks like I am. Okay. That comes from trying to keep up with Gerhard. So let me just give you a broad sort of survey of the core of Rawls' ideas in his first book, A Theory of Justice. And then down here, I'm going to talk a little bit about how that was revised and amended. And I just realize as I'm saying this, it's a very broad audience, and I'm a philosopher, and you guys know what philosophers are like. So you'd help me out if you would just like wave. Like, I will inevitably use language or drift into things that may not be familiar. Just wave at me so I can explain it, okay? On the opening paragraph of Rawls' book, he proclaims that as an important principle of our society, they don't need to write this down, do they?
Every word.
It's not going to be on an exam. If it's ever on an exam, tell me. If they ever put it on an exam, tell me. I'll come back here and I'll put a hex on the man who's here. It'll be magic against magic. He says, We believe that each person has an inviolability based in justice, that even the welfare of society as a whole cannot override. So that has a very fundamental moral intuition. And you can see how that might go to talking about rights. We're going to protect that inviolability of each person by surrounding that person with a thick perimeter or fence of rights. That's not quite what Rawls does. What Rawls does in his book is argue for two principles of justice. One, that a just society under, we're not talking severe or conditions of hardship, but under conditions of reasonable affluence, a just society will guarantee each citizen equal liberty and the most extensive liberty that is consistent with everybody having that liberty. In other words, we're going to have like the freest possible society understood as the like minimal restrictions. And then secondly, this is a sort of tricky part, so I'll explain it. He says, again, as a principle of justice, a just society will be a society that will not have inequalities unless those inequalities have the effect of raising the lowest positions even better. Okay? So he's there acknowledging that sort of incentives argument. If we pay people more, for example, if they work harder, then we will do that only if it pulls the bottom position up even higher than it would be otherwise. Now, that's not, lots of people argued about that, but what I want to draw to your attention is how Rawls argued for that. You see, because Rawls was a philosopher, and secondly, he was kind of maybe old-fashioned. I start to feel this way sometimes. Like, Rawls didn't think it really mattered a whole lot what he thought, or what I thought, or what you thought. What he thought mattered were reasons for the position. That's what philosophers do. They're trying to figure out reasons. And what Rawls thought that he could demonstrate that as a theorem of justice with the same sort of logical power that you can find in Euclidean geometry. Now, it didn't quite work, but it was a really heroic attempt. And if you remember, as I said, this is at a time when people say, you can't do it. It's all about values. You can't do that stuff, right? Rawls comes along and says, not only are we going to do it, we're going to show that these principles are right. And here, very like simply, is his argument. There's two parts of it. The first is the veil of ignorance. I see some smiles. No, this isn't like a Turkish dance. No, it's the veil of ignorance is this. He says, suppose you had to choose a society that you were going to live in. But suppose you had to do it without knowing how your choice would affect yourself in that society. In other words, he says, imagine you as the reader have the opportunity to design a society that would be a just society, but to guarantee that it will be fair, and Rawls's book was called Justice as Fairness, to guarantee that it will be fair, we're going to prevent you from like squidging the result to favor yourself. So you're going to have to choose what a just society would be under a veil of ignorance about who you are and where you are in that situation. So the thought procedure of Rawls's work requires what he called this original position. Persons in the original position don't know how old they are. They don't know their sex or gender. They don't know what time in history they are. Well, then, who are they? They are the perfect philosopher's stick figure. That's all. No long hair, no breasts, no whatever. Nothing. They're free. That is to say, I'll just explain these terms. They're free. That is to say, no one is like under an obligation to anybody else. Each person can make their own choice. They're equal. Again, they're all equally placed. I don't have to... you don't have to suck up to the instructor in this course. Right? You say what you think. They're rational. In other words, able... Now, Rawls had an economist view of rationality. So you're able to work out the means to getting whatever ends you might want. They're self-interested. In that, we'll have to come back to that in a moment, but they're self-interested in that they don't know who they're going to be. And they don't know what they care about or what they will care about. But they want that person to flourish. They want that person to have a good life. So they're going to choose with a view to protecting positions in the society that they might occupy. And then finally, this mutually disinterested is really, I want to come back to that, it's weird. But it means that nobody cares about where they stand in relation to other people at this point. What it means is, if you can have all the things that you want, and somebody else has all the things that they want, plus one more thing, that doesn't matter to you because you don't care about it. All you care about is satisfying the needs of your own life. That's what there's a lot that might be said here. I'll come back to it. But do you have the broad idea for now? You don't know who you are. You don't know what you care about. You don't even know what your ends in life are. You have the general knowledge of the social sciences. Right, Gerhard? You have the general knowledge of the social sciences. So on that basis, you're going to choose a society. You're going to lay out a society. Well, I can see the suspense in the room is palpable. I can see everybody on the edge of their chairs. What's the result? What are we going to do? Well, Rawls says, what's the smart thing to do under those circumstances? The smart thing to do, Rawls says, is to protect the worst off position. Because you might be there. He claimed a lot of stuff from his Harvard colleagues that I won't bore you with, but that's essentially the idea. Think of it like this. Think of it like this. Suppose a weather forecast for tomorrow. The weather forecaster comes on and says, tomorrow, it's kind of weird. We're not quite sure what's going to happen. We know one of two things is going to happen. Either it's going to be brutally cold. It's going to be minus 40 with driving rain. I don't know how you would get that, but... Right? Or, it's a 50% out possibility. But the alternative, which is also 50%, is it might be plus 25 and sunny. So here you are at home, and you know that, sort of like it is now, and you're going to set out for your day's work, your day at school. But you're going to see this weather change during the day. How are you going to prepare for it? Well, it seems to me there's three choices. You could go out wearing tomorrow the same stuff you wore today, in which case you'll either be hideously cold or hideously uncomfortable and hot. You might do that. Or you could go out, you could get out your shorts and your t-shirt, right? You could do that. Or you could get your parka and take that along with you. Okay, let's do a straw vote. How many of you would go out tomorrow with just the same way you're dressed today? A couple. All right, three, four, okay. Next, so how many of you would go out tomorrow wearing shorts and a t-shirt? Nobody? Okay, well, no, it doesn't matter. No, by the way.
That's the wrong answer.
So then, next, final question. How many of you would take... Tomorrow would take a parka. Don't be timid. Get those hands up. Sure. Get your, because you're the rational people. Rational choice theory predicts that under conditions of uncertainty, asserts that under conditions of uncertainty, the prudent or rational thing to do is to guard against the worst outcomes. Okay. So Rawls says these people, because they're rational and they don't know what they care about, they want to protect themselves, and let's say they're not worried about looking silly. What are you doing, Don, wearing that parka? Right? They're not worried about that. He said, they are going to choose to protect the worst positions in the society. And as a consequence, they will make, in terms of economic distributions, they will make it as good as possible. And in terms of liberty, again, they will make that as good as possible. Any questions about this so far? I thought one or two of you might say that you're not persuaded that that is the rational thing to do. And I thought, for example, you over there, or the four of you who raised your hands saying, you are prepared to wear clothes tomorrow that you know, whatever happens, will be inappropriate. Right? Like four people said they would go out tomorrow dressed as they were today, knowing that that won't work. It'll either be too hot, or they'll either be like really uncomfortably hot or really uncomfortably cold. Does anybody want to like have any questions about this? Well, as I say, this was supposed to be executed with the power of a theorem. My teacher of the time, my supervisor, not, by the way, a nice guy, but that's a story for another day. He put this question. Thanks. He raised this question. He said, does anybody here ever go to the races? Nobody? One. Okay, one, two, thank you. All right, that's all we need, two people. All right. When you guys go to the races, do you bet the, what's the opposite of a long shot?
Sure thing.
Okay, so the what?
The sure thing. The sure thing. Do you bet the sure thing? Always, always?
Do you?
No.
Do you ever, are you ever tempted by the long shot? Is that irrational?
Gambling.
What's that? It's gambling. That's right. It's called a gamble. It's called. That's what it is. So, what my teacher Brian Berry said, it's the same thing. But if you're going to design a society in this way, like you don't know who you are, but you might say, okay, I might be, like a totally incapable person. In which case, I want to protect the worst position. But I might be, like, awesome. In which case, I want that. I don't want to be held back. And so it has come over time to be recognized that that Rawls' theory doesn't have the, like, the logical power that he hoped it did. But on the other hand, that was 1970. And certainly in the 20 years after that, and if you remember particularly that it provided people an opportunity to talk about these issues, it allowed a whole generation of theorists to talk about issues of justice, social justice. But in doing so, Rawls's theory was always in the background. It was the work, in a way, whether people liked it or disagreed with it, it was the work that gave them permission to pursue those questions themselves. So it has that really lasting importance. And as a result, even though people don't buy the argument as logically necessary, that basic theory is like the central way in which political theorists have come to think about these questions. As maximum liberty, and then like protecting the least favored position. But also these. Now before I leave, I'd like to comment a little bit about this. The key to this is, Rawls says, once we choose the principles, we cancel the veil of ignorance,
and presto, you know who you are. And so at that point, you're living in the society, you're going to be the beneficiary of those liberties and those social distributions. On we go.
And so at that point, you are able to use this freedom to make all kinds of choices for yourself. If, for example, you want to practice some weird religion, you can. If, for example, I mean, it doesn't matter. Anything you want to do, so long as it doesn't violate the liberties of others, you're going to be free to do. So you really do have here a free society. But what matters to us as philosophers, not as opposed to politicians, but what matters to us as philosophers is how we understand those freedoms. And I want to point out a couple of problems. The first is this mutual disinterest. Now, Rawls is saying, once you're out of the veil of ignorance, you're free to make whatever associations you want, whatever friendships you want, or not. That's okay. The difficulty is that the conception of the society in the background is of a society in which people are not connected at all. They're not connected by love, by family, by tradition, by religious, intellectual, spiritual commitment. And as a consequence, there is, I mean, this is a full freedom because you in your life are not restricted by any have-tos. There's nothing you have to do out of honor or loyalty to your parents or to your family tradition or to your church. Everything is elective. You got that? Everything is. That's created like a huge subcontinence inside our Canadian, American, European political life. Like, do we really understand ourselves in those ways? The answer is no. I've never met a single. I mean, anybody who understood themselves that way would need a kind of mental help. No, I didn't mean to be funny with that. I just mean that would involve a degree of dissociation that would verge on the clinical. So, like, Rawls never denied that. Right? He just said, but this is the best way to think about it. And that's where the argument goes. If I could give you an example. I was the external examiner in a thesis. I just mentioned this because I thought it was funny. I was the external examiner in a PhD thesis on Rawls, where the person was defending Rawls. And I said to the candidate was a young woman. In fact, not just a young woman, a young mother. So I said to her, okay, are you saying that if a person is in this original position, and she happened to be, she doesn't know it, but she happens to be, let's say, a single mother of Aboriginal origin, that wouldn't matter? At which point, one of the other examiners, cover your ears, some of you, one of the other examiners erupted and he said, for Christ's sake, Don, what's that got to do with anything? And my point about that is, for a lot of us, it has everything to do with. What's it have to do with it? For some people, nothing. And for other people, everything. Likewise, now I'm verging into Taylor, and I'll say more about this in a moment. Likewise, is it credible to think about a human being where you abstract away all the things that they care about? I find that quite difficult. So I'm going to come back to that. Yeah, we've got lots of time. Interrupt if you have any, because I mean, I can imagine that some of this will puzzle you and some of it could irritate you. Like these are different. Yes.
I just kind of have a quick point, and maybe this is completely anything to do with what we're talking about. But you're like when you're talking about the long shot and the sure thing. If everybody vetted for the sure thing, there would be no long shot.
Yeah.
What is like? I'm just wondering what does the competition of those two have to do with each other? Like. We were to all just go with the one certain thing. There wouldn't even be that other choice.
You obviously know a lot more about betting than I do. I'm not once a year as a fat guy. I've never worked that out. But I remember I took my grandchildren last summer, and I was trying to explain to them how the odds work. You're right. That wasn't quite the point I was trying to make.
No, I know. But I'm just saying, even when you're talking about this, the original position.
Yeah.
Sure.
Would there be the one if you didn't have the other to say that's not the original position?
I have
the opposite of the original.
I have some.
I don't know what I did with my black. Here it is. I have some difficulty talking about money distributions because, say, I have known in my life some people who were like really successful and wealthy, made tons of money, but I don't know why they did. Like, if you had enough to buy the books and copy and wine. You know, why would you then not read that book? Right? So you could earn more money.
That,
I've never understood that. But you probably can understand there are people like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now let's think of our, we're going to imagine our high IQ person. I'm on my way to law school where I'm going to practice tax law and make a gazillion bucks. Right? Put this person behind the veil of ignorance. She, because it will, of course, be female. She doesn't know the following. She doesn't know she wants to go to law school, but she doesn't know that she's really smart either. See? But what she would know looking at our society is the people who are really smart about tax law are going to be at a certain place. Here's our income distribution. Where is she going to be? Yeah, up in here somewhere, right? Depending on how hard she works, maybe she should be there. She's going to be up there somewhere. But she doesn't, see, she doesn't know. That's the point about the veil of ignorance. So all Barry wanted to say is that Rawls takes it over from, it's a point in econometrics that then really got developed inside international relations theory. That the principle for rational choice under conditions of uncertainty is to protect against the worst that could happen. Okay? And so he says, what this person is going to do is instead try to get a society that will look like, and I mean those relative positions. The best won't be as high, the worst won't be as low. Okay? And Barry just was saying, but this person, like, she doesn't know whether in that society she'd be up here or down here. But she might gamble. Because people do. For example, when they go to the racetrack, they might gamble. Or they might gamble as some of you evidently would have on how you would dress on the cold days against that weather forecast. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Now there's something. My wife and I went to this therapist. She said, "What every successful marriage needs is an eraser." To get rid of things that get said. Well, what every good political philosopher needs is an eraser to get rid of some examples. Because this is... I'm just trying to answer your question, but it could create a whole lot of problems. The idea of thinking about a society in terms of, I'm a high IQ, I might be high IQ, but maybe I should gamble. That doesn't make a lot of sense, so we're... like philosophers here. Put that on one side, we'll come back to this. If I could just remind you where we were with Rolf. Yes?
I just want to ask on this mutually disinterested stuff. Because when you started out saying
liberalism, its commitment to full and free development for each person, right?
Yes.
If that's so, this mutually disinterested wouldn't work because being our full development requires a social context to develop in. That we require reciprocity between each other.
Wonderful question. Did everybody hear the question? Great. Can I repeat the question and then you correct me? The point of the question is this.
If I started by saying the recent liberal tradition is committed to the full and free development of each person. I'm sorry, what is your name?
Marilyn says, but wait, then you can't say mutually disinterested. Because Marilyn says,
part of the full and free development of the person is like engagement with other people and the ability to engage with other people. The very opposite of this.
Who says?
Well, I'm not sure who says. It's just the way it is. I couldn't have developed without a reciprocal relationship between other people.
It's a crucial point. I'm not mocking this at all when I say who says. I want to suggest this to you. I agree with you. I would like to see the school system at every level like reflect that in the way that we teach kids and bring it. I say this as a grandparent, right? Our kids, I have one grandson who can play any computer game devised by man but can't have a conversation with another human being. Unless it's online.
So
that value that you have points you, and sorry, that value that we have points us in the direction of a certain kind of society, a certain model of social organization. We're going to encourage kids to do that in the schools. We're going to, in a way, reward them for doing it. Like, I don't mean to make too much out of that, right? So you have, in that value, you have implicitly there a seed of justice that you want to plant in the society and have flourish. And for you, if I could put it this way, that would be a good society to live in. And I'm going to come back to that word good in a few minutes. The problem is, you know there are people who disagree. Starting with my brainiac grandson. But there are people who disagree. And what's more, there are people who have ideas about what a good society would be that I suspect...
Let's try it. Can I pick on you for a minute? Tell me something about a society that for you would be hideous to live in. Anybody want to help her out? What?
Educating women. That would be hideous.
Okay, I'm going to There are people who will tell my wife if I get near that, so I'm just going to stay away from it. No, seriously, think of things like, I mean, maybe for you, a society in which everybody talked about hockey all the time. my wife gave me an Oilers ticket, right? We went to the game 2 weeks ago.
There were all kinds of fights, right?
We're up on the nose, there's a fight and everybody is on their feet, right? And wait, there have been gorgeous goals, there's a fight. And my wife, who is a Quaker, my wife turns to me, everybody is on their feet, right? My wife turns to me and says, loudly so I can hear, why do they do that? And I went, or we're next. Does anybody want to propose anything other than a society in which people talk endlessly about the Oilers?
One that would undo torture.
Well,
to you, or torture.
Well,
torture.
We have no, but people right now, it's a critical time for us. Like, there are people at different stages in our community, different stages in their ability to recognize humiliation. And we see those people moving away from those practices, trying to get them out of their lives, and then being offended when they happen around. So we can imagine, see, like just societies in which people are treated like dirt, that would not be a nice society, okay? Are there people who think that that's good? It brings the best out of you. It makes a man out of you. It's teach, all right? So, these are... There's, I don't know, 60 people here? There's 60 different views about what matters in life. And every one of those views about what matters in life is a little seed for justice, for a just society. Now, Rawls does believe in equality. I have no more, I have a PhD. I have no more right to tell you what's right and wrong than you have to tell me. We're equal in that. So the issue I'm trying to exploit when you raise this issue about disinterest, Rawls will agree and say, his defense is, all I am saying is that for purposes of choosing the society, I'm going to suppose that people don't, in fact, care about how they stand in relation to other people. Once they're out of the veil of ignorance, then they're free to be whoever they are and to live their lives on whatever trajectory and destiny is called for. That's his answer. But the reason I'm citing this is to take you really to the next stage in Rawls's account and where Taylor will come into play. Because, did you have a question?
I just have a question. When he's saying that this is the optimal society that he's looking forward to, it is an optimal society, but is it possible? We can talk and say about optimal societies, and we can always say that we want things to happen. We can create rules, but aren't we?
Why do you think it might not be possible?
Human nature?
Human nature, or greed, or... you do see here, I would say, I'm going to, if I could, duck the question by saying, I think you're quite right to raise it. I think it's a really important question. And one of the difficulties about political philosophy, like through my lifetime, has been it's been quite abstract. So haven't paid enough attention to questions of that kind. They're very important, okay? Like the concrete realities of life. Rawls never did that. Never crossed his mind to take up. Is it possible? Now I'm gonna. But unlike Rawls, I have a political life. I'm a philosopher. I'm quite separately, in a way, completely unconnected. I have a political life, and some of that political life is as a teacher. So I would say to you, we're at a very wonderful time. Things probably couldn't be worse, but they couldn't be better. Tomorrow, the Americans, against all odds, are going to install a guy who brings them a message of hope. I hope you have that same message. So when I hear someone say, is it possible? Well, what three words are we going to say? Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Is it easy? No. Will we fail many times? Yes. Is it worthwhile? Yes, we can. Okay. So, if I could take you back then to the fact that we have in this room like many different perspectives on these questions. When Rawls still, he still believes this. He still believes this. But he's concerned about the issues of justification in the society. And so in his later life, he developed another theory, or part of a theory. It's tied to this in ways, but... Oh, I'm going to have to... Let's see if I can... Yeah. Oh, okay. Rawls says, in his later theory, he's given what he called reasonable pluralism in any society. All pluralism means is... It's not a homogeneous society. There are in the society people who care about very different kinds of things. So given that, we have to have some fair way of sorting out what gets promoted and what doesn't. And I want to say, I hope this is like in the forefront of your mind, that's not in the first instance a question of what laws we have. It's not principally a question about whether we will allow gay marriage. It's principally about how we deal with one another as citizens, and principally about how we educate our children, or in my case, grandchildren. Like, what kind of a society it is going to be. Now, Rawls says that given this liberty he promotes, he says that any basic policy issues should be addressed in terms that could be accepted by any other citizen in the community. For brevity, I'm going to present this as more as simpler than Rawls intended it. In a way, it actually does disservice to the nuanced depth of Rawls' own thought. I'm just going to talk about how it's come to be understood. It's come to be understood in terms of saying any policy issue has to be presented and justified in terms that, well, exactly as I put it there, that everyone can accept. We're going to have, we have a public holiday called Christmas. What does Christmas celebrate? The birth of Christ. So, as a community, we set aside a day for the suspension of business to celebrate a religious event that isn't a religious event for everyone. What does this say about that? No, you can't do that. No, you can't. Okay?
Don, why not? I think people who do accept Christmas, who aren't, it doesn't have that principle, except a holiday.
Yeah, I mean that's what any number of my students have said to me in classes on this kind, and I always think at that point that maybe they still do believe in Santa Claus. Because on things like that, what matters is not just what they believe, but what the people around them believe. Right. Now, if you are from a faith community that is non-Christian, like, you're going to see Christmas as the day that the Christians own for the celebration of the Christian community. Whatever is in your own mind as a... Do you see what I mean? So, for example, you'll see in the United States, the big holiday in the United States, the big family day, is Thanksgiving. Because that's the day they celebrate the survival, the first year of the colonies. So they all get together to celebrate that. In lots of places, Christmas Day itself has stopped being itself a holiday. So that's where that's going. Now, let me say, yeah, because I want to give you some examples. So I'm going to do Taylor quickly, or try to. I don't ordinarily like just reading what's on a screen, but I'm gonna do that basically here for the first 3 bits. Taylor. Now, you'll remember, as I said, Taylor was acknowledged as one of the half dozen leading intellectuals in the Western world until he started talking about spirituality. And then, let me give you an example. In the late 80s, I guess it was, I organized the meetings for all the political scientists in the country. We invited Charles Taylor to come, and then because he was going to come, we had a panel on his work, and so because he was coming, a guy from Cambridge came and a guy from Johns Hopkins came, and somebody, I forget, there was a fourth person. So we had this like really interesting panel. But I want to say, like, these people came from elsewhere because they wanted to take part in this panel. And we had to keep moving the venue because it was like everybody wanted to go to this thing. Last year, the American, this is the Canadian Political Science Association. Last summer, the American Political Science Association, as part of its annual meetings, they are something like 15 times larger than the Canadian meeting. They had a session on Charles Taylor. I went to that session, and there were 15 people in the room. Now, there could be lots of other explanations for that, but it seemed to me that once Taylor started talking about spirituality and God, people started getting nervous. Well, now, but what does Taylor hold for? The first main thing he says, Taylor says, that what matters, and I'm going to call that the good, because he does, the good, or what matters, should be more central in our public life and citizenship. And that right now it is suffocated by what he calls procedural liberalism, the Rawlsian approach. For example, if I could use, was it Margaret?
Sure.
Maryland. Maryland. If I use Maryland's example. The procedural or Rawlsian liberal will say, we're going to put fences around those ideas of what's good. So you want sociability, that's going to be on inside this box. Somebody else wants aggression, that's going to be over here. And we're going to protect those choices with rights so that other people can't tell you what to do. And Taylor sort of preached that and says, what kind of a community is that? What Taylor wants is to say, if you really care about that, you should talk to this person. And if you really care about that, you should talk to this person. We should sort it out. In other words, get rid of the fences. And so it's a different kind of politics. So that we want, he says, as a community, we want not necessarily an agreement, never in complete agreement, but we do want our political life to be in the center of that. We want it to be discussions about what we care about. Now let me give an example of that in terms of the value of freedom. In a procedural or the now sort of standard liberal view, freedom is important because it protects people's ability to do what they want, whatever that might be. And so it specifically protects them from the interference by other people. That's a private and an individual value. Agreed? Here's a different way you could think about the same freedom. We are a free society. We care that every person in the society should have the best possible chance to live a full and free life. And we, as a society, are committed to making that happen. You see the difference? In one, we assert the private values of a range of individuals, which are protected by these rights. In the other, we assert it as a value of our community that we're going, as a community, to make happen. And then the third thing he says, he stresses, is the importance of identity and sub-community. So whereas, you know, you had these examples I gave you before about the veil of ignorance, Taylor will say, like, he has never suggested that any person's life should be directed by other people. And therefore, the fact that you might be from a faith community or from a certain kind of family or from a certain kind of culture is no reason for making you do anything. And certainly no reason for making you stay in that community. None whatever. But what Taylor does want to say is that those backgrounds are important as to who we are. That's all. I personally believe that the whole idea of human rights, as we understand it, is a Judeo-Christian concept. It reflects a certain view about man being created by God. Now we can kick that away,
you know, we can rub it off the board. But it's still there.
So Taylor, and that really can matter. Just one more thing, and then I'll give you some examples, and then I think you guys will really want to argue. But it really can matter because I teach in this area, and I see students all the time just about to say something and stop. And what they're just about to say is, suppose we're talking about gay marriage. The student will say, or abortion, the student will start to say, well, I'm Jewish, or I'm Hasidic, or I'm Muslim, or I'm Catholic. But what they want to say is, I'm Catholic, and so the way I sort of think about these issues is as this. Because that's where we do that thinking and talking, is in those sub-communities. But what this alternative approach does is require that we take all of that and sort of cut it away and talk in a language that is nobody's language. Now, so like, what's the difference? I'm thinking particularly of this one student who's just lovable because he likes people. He's really keen what they say. And so when people say things that is different, like, he wants to know, like, why would you say that? Right? And he's all the time about to say something like hideous, like, Catholics don't think that, you know, so it's sort of like a Catholic view on any of these things. But that's what he, you know, because that's how he's been raised and the schools he's gone to and all of that stuff. And it's been amazing to watch this because the first, I told him one day, I want you to do it. So he went in and he did it. You could have heard a pin drop in the room. Now, a bunch of you guys are students, right? Okay, so you go into your class tomorrow and on some issue, I don't know, suppose you're talking about Obama's inauguration and you say, imagine this. What's your name?
Janet?
Janet. So suppose Janet says, I think this is really important because I'm Jewish. Or, I think this is really important because I'm Muslim. People are going to look, I think, a little strangely at you. If you were to say, not that you would, I think this is really important as a woman of color, they're not going to say anything. Right? It's weird. It's just totally weird. So that's what Taylor is getting at. So he is not saying, well, so we should set up a state church. Not saying anything like that. What he is saying is we should be prepared to talk as a community about the things that matter to us. And we should be prepared to legislate on that basis. And in talking about the things that matter to us, we're going to have to talk about them as the people we are. Now, some of us come from a religious backgrounds. Some of us come from a religious spiritual community. Some people come from religious communities. Just talk about the things the way you are. If my student Jeff Sigalet says, well, I'm a Catholic and I think this, does that mean that anybody else in the room has to be Catholic? Nope. It's just a convenient way for him to talk. He could say, I have heard him say, well, I'm an Oilers fan. And actually what he says is, well, I'm not an Oilers fan. So, okay. So now here are some examples, and feel free to jump in. The first one, you wanted to break it 8:15? Okay. The first one is the, excuse me, the Supreme Court decisions on the possession of child pornography. Now this goes back about 10 years, the Sharp decisions. And then, they start. Are there any lawyers here? Good. Okay. So, oh. Okay. So, do you know these cases? Oh, they're bizarre. Well, so I have to tell you. Well, first of all, everything I know about law can be written on my little thumbnail. But I know this: that at the appeal level, questions of fact cannot be considered. Only questions of law. Okay. Now, Robin Sharp was arrested for being in possession of a whole batch of kiddie porn. He was brought to trial. He did his own defense. And at his defense, he got just a whole bunch of people, I think sociologists and stuff, right, academic people, to sit in the stand and say, the studies show that a person is no more nor less likely to commit sexual aggression against children as a result of exposure or non-exposure to kiddie porn. With me? In other words, the possession of child porn, these experts are saying, the possession of it doesn't have a causality in creating sexual aggression. The crowd were like, you know, it's one of those like nothing trials. They've scheduled like a day for it, right? Well, it goes a week. The crowd are totally unprepared. The end of it, the trial judge says, I think he's got a case, and the crown haven't answered it. So, let him off. It went to appeal. So now, see, the point is that at appeal now, they cannot consider the causality question anymore. All they can consider is the law. So they're stuck with this view, a finding of fact, that the stuff doesn't cause harm. Well, what's any person going to do? Like, if it doesn't cause harm, how could you stop the person from possessing it? I mean, that basic charter freedom issue. So it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. People keep saying, we're stuck. The Supreme Court had two decisions. The majority decision went like this. Yes, it's true that scientist after scientist said there is no causality. But we know better. We know, because common sense tells us, even if the scientists don't get it, that the possession of this stuff leads to attacks. And so on that basis, they upheld the law and then had Sharp convicted. The minority court, three justices from Quebec, their decision should be, I don't know, written in stone someplace. Their decision sort of goes like this. What are you guys talking about? They said, who cares whether it causes harm? The decision says, what would be wrong with a society saying, we don't want people amusing themselves by watching kids getting whatever it is they do in these things? And so they said, we just don't care. But all the way through it, is they have this view that says, what's the matter with you guys? Like, you're taking your liberalism way too far. You see where this is going? Now, what are they saying? They're with Maryland. They're saying, we want children to be presented and protected in our society in a certain way. And if you don't like it, well, go somewhere else. That's the kind of society we want to live in. And the majority court is saying, Basic liberties. Now, does that mean liberties don't matter? No. No. Not at all. It just means, I'm talking here about a choice between two kinds of debate, two kinds of ways you can talk about liberties. Tolerance. I'm going to quote Taylor here from a podcast I heard. He was asked, doesn't this lead to the kind of view I was talking about? Doesn't this lead to being kind of intolerant to people that you disagree with? Right? And I have to understand, I wish I could imitate Taylor, because he's funny and charming and very cultured, right? So he kind of chuckles, and he says, well, it depends what you mean by tolerance. On this rights protected view of tolerance, here's what tolerance is. You can say and believe what you think. I won't say it out loud, but your view disgusts me. In fact, Tilly said, your view makes me want to puke. It is so hideously disgusting. But you can do it. Said, here's a different view of tolerance. His view of tolerance goes, huh? You like the calorie flames? Or you like, I don't know, you like child pornography? Like, what's in it? Or, like, tell me, what's going on there? In other words, this is an inclusive mind trying to meet one another so they can understand where they are. Now, when Taylor said that, I have to say my thought was, this is being awfully generous about people. Because historically, I keep using it and putting it away. Historically, these fences, we'll get rid of our agro person, but unquestionably, those rights as fences have the advantage of protecting people, in some cases, from the malice or the ignorance or the deliberate mean or stupidity of people in their community. And sometimes as communities, we just do go bad. I'm not talking in here, I hope it's clear, I'm not talking about other people. I'm talking about myself and our community. Sometimes we go bad, and rights can provide protections against that. So don't get me wrong, I am not saying that there shouldn't be rights, nor Taylor's not saying there shouldn't be rights. The question is, how do we understand them, and how do we come to establish them? And one, we sort of say, there's a kind of entitlement about that person in there, inside that box. And the other sort of say, well, the person's part of a broader society. We have to look at what matters in that broader society. Now, the final example is multiculturalism. You guys did this last week, right? Did you read Gutman's introduction to? Well, the introduction's kind of funny because she's very nice about Taylor, but Amy doesn't. She refers to Taylor as that Canadian. What's all that about? For Taylor, here's what it's about. I'm going to betray myself as a... I'll just give an example. I'm going to betray myself as a kind of person who should be, like, whipped out of the university and whipped out of polite society. But just for an example, I just have to tell you that I occasionally notice the differences between men and women. Now, I know we're supposed to be blind to all of those things, right? But I occasionally notice those kinds of things. Does that mean I mean, not once in my life, I have two sisters, right? I have two sisters. Not once in my life has it ever once occurred to me to say something like, you're just saying that because you're a woman. Not once in my life has it ever occurred to me to think that the fact that someone was female would explain anything at all, right? Like, there's 100 billion females on the planet. There's 100 billion different people on the planet. But I do happen to notice whether people are male or female. So I have a question for the women in the room. Suppose you went through a whole week and I'll suppose that you're straight. It would just alter the terms if you're not. Suppose you went through a whole week and you didn't once have the experience of a male noticing that you were female. What would you think? You put that?
Well, it probably depends on the guys.
That's what.
It might be the normal. I think it would be. Yeah.
Okay, so like one question is it right to form a view about a person because they're female or non-white? It's not so much that it's not right, as it is just plain stupid. Right? Just plain stupid. And I want to say, as one citizen, that I don't want basic social policies being framed on the basis of stupidity. So, is there anything wrong with noticing that someone's skin color, hair color, like this beautiful woman came up to me in the Sugar Bowl the other night and gave me this hug. I'd never seen her before in my life. She's blonde. She's a student from 4 years ago, and she blonded her hair. Her hair was your color before, right? I didn't recognize her until she spoke, right? So what I'm trying to get at here is, when it comes to multiculturalism, we do people a wrong by not noticing the ways in which they're different. We do people a wrong by judging them on the basis of that difference instead of who they are. But it's certainly a wrong. Now, I want to give you one last example. But I'm waiting for... I thought you guys would be jumping in and saying, Don Carmichael, that's outrageous. You should go back to Edmonton and never come back here. I'll give you one last example. I went to a conference on teaching 4 years ago, and it was at McMaster University, where they had this really interesting... Arts and Science program is really interesting. In first year, every student is assigned to... what do they call it? It's not a seminar, but think of it as like a seminar. There's a group of 15 students, and these students meet 3 times a week.
Cohort.
It's like a cohort. Yeah. But the point is that this isn't a course. It's what it's supposed to do is like bring them together and be interdisciplinary in ways that their other things aren't. So they set up the same thing for all the people at the conference, and they had like a whole bunch of cohort groups that you could sign up. As you can imagine, technology in the classroom was one. There were a couple, but there was one on diversity and cultural diversity. So I signed up for that. Now, as it happened, so I went to this room, and when I went into this room, it turned out there weren't enough people for more than one. I went into this room, and when I went in, I was surprised to find, first of all, that I was the only male. Secondly, that I was the only white person there. And thirdly, I can't bear to use this expression, but I was the only old person there. I have never felt so marginalized in my whole... I was a complete outsider, right? I went in there, and all these women turned and looked at me and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, isn't this... Can you tell me where the culture and diversity... they said, "This is it." I said, "Well, like, I came because I'm interested in that stuff." And they said, "Why?" Now I want to tell you what I told them, because I'd never thought of it before. Like, I just knew it mattered, but the reason came to me instantly. Because in my classes, which are this kind of political theory, abstract stuff at the university, a good third of my students are not the kinds of students you had in a political science classroom 30 years ago. First of all, 60% of them are women. Women didn't used to do political science. They certainly didn't used to do political theory. But they are from like a whole variety of different cultures. I've come to the view that what I do when I teach political philosophy is I teach people how to talk like Rawls. I teach people how to use expressions like the veil of ignorance. I teach people that it's important, if they want to make a case in Canadian public life, that it's important that they not identify themselves. it is important that they not make references to specific cultural traditions or skin colors or gender. I stood there and I looked at this room full of all of these different skin colors and stuff and thought, like, I actually get teaching awards, and what I'm doing is teaching kids to talk white. They learn this stuff in the classroom. They go to law school. But while they're learning the stuff in the classroom, they go home to their families where Punjabi is the language or where various other languages are the languages. Right? So all of that is going on there. And there seems to be like zero interface between the stuff that we're trying to do together in terms of learning and who they are as persons. How many teaching awards do you think you'd need to do that? Right? So for me, I hope it's clear. I said at the beginning, I'm going to conclude now. I said at the beginning that I would be treating, in effect, I won't even try going back to the pictures, that I would be treating Rawls as the bad guy. I do not mean, I hope it's clear when I was saying that, I don't mean any disrespect for Rawls. He is a major thinker of major importance. And I don't want to suggest that the alternative is clear or easy. I have just wanted really to show you two things. The first is that and why we are moving increasingly into a culture, like a public political culture, where we are required to talk about basic policy issues in terms that are identity free. And where they are identity free in terms where we can talk about what's right and wrong, but we can't, or feel we shouldn't, talk about the things that matter, and the things that by mattering we might work on together to make matter in the society as a whole. So that's the first and main thing. And then secondly, by using the example, maybe a dubious example, of my friend Charles Taylor, to try to show you the advantages of the alternative. So, thank you very much.